We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this woman, not traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life. Founder.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other will both get value from the episode.
So what are you passionate about these days?
Huh, that's a really interesting question. It's such like a, I feel like there's a lifelong answer, you know, like there's like underarching themes in my life that I'm passionate about. But then I guess saying these days implies that it's kind of has changed over time, you know, or that like recently I'm passionate about new things.
So if I strike the these days from the question and just say, what are you passionate about?
Yeah.
Is that easier for you to answer?
It is. Funnily enough, I mean, it just, yeah, I guess it just makes me think broader, you know, like I think of being passionate as like, you know, what you like to do when, what you think about when you can think about whatever you want, or what you do when you can do whatever you want. And last night I came home after dinner with a friend and picked up the guitar and I played for like an hour and I picked out a bunch of songs, and I still continue to be really excited and passionate about music and the creativity of it, and just kind of sitting with something and creating, you know, creating a song out of nothingness is really exciting. But it's weird to say that, like, I guess I have a lot of passions is probably what it boils down to, because that's not something that I spend a ton of time doing, even though it does like fill me and it is exciting. How about you? How would you answer that question?
Well, right now I'm like neck deep in aerial yoga training. So I think that's what I'm like into right now.
Yeah.
Which I feel like makes me sound more fickle than you, because you're like, wow, these deep things I've loved my whole life. And I'm like, no, this is just like the thing I like right now. And I like it so much that I want to teach other people to do it. And I like it so much that I want to integrate it into my therapy practice. So yeah, I'm doing a teacher training, two teacher trainings actually, in different types of aerial yoga, and spending like hours suspended from the ceiling. So I must be passionate about that. That's the only way to like endure the sore muscles and silk burns I'm getting.
I would guess. Yeah. And I mean, I think you and I look at it differently because of our personalities are just different. I think that you relish new experiences and seek change and love, you know, like your love of travel and such is reflected in that. And I tend to, not that I haven't changed my passions over time, because they have, but mine just take a lot longer to do.
So part of my microconf talk, as you know, because you were there, but for those of you who weren't there, part of my microcom talk that I gave in the growth edition was based on this article that I read in the Journal of Brain Mapping, I think is what the journal was, that looked at the ways that founders' brains respond when they're confronted with images of their company. So the researchers had a question of like, do founders love their companies? Do they love their companies like parents love their children? And it turns out that yes, they do. That, you know, when an entrepreneur, in this case, this was done with a population of men, so I'll use the male pronoun, although that's certainly not true of all founders. Go girls. When these male entrepreneurs were looking at images of their companies, the brain regions that lit up were brain regions often associated, sort of central brain, so associated with lots of like dopamine and pleasure and reward activities. So reward centers in the brain. And then part of the other brain regions that were really ignited were parts of the brain that have to do with critical social assessment. So like reading the motives and intentions of another person and judging them. So I guess like the bottom line here is that neurologically, entrepreneurs love their businesses and tend to withhold critical judgment, like don't do a good job of integrating data because of the sort of warm, fuzzy feelings that go along inherently with spending so much time creating something that you love.
Like you've said, you've kind of summarized it as love shuts down critical assessment, much like when you have someone showing you a picture of their children and they say, aren't these kids, you know, amazing? And they may or may not be, but it, you know, the parent is certainly not assessing them on an unbiased scale. And in essence, the same thing is happening here with a founder.
Yeah, founders are very, very biased towards their own endeavors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they think, it sounds like they think they're more likely to succeed. They probably would expect a higher purchase price than any, you know, third party seller who's just coming in cold. And there's just a lot of emotion tied to it.
So I thought it was a really, really fascinating article for lots of reasons, but it sort of, I think, could be an interesting conversation. It started this conversation in terms of thinking about what do you do with your passion or your love? You know, sometimes people will say, do what you love or follow your passion. And in a sense, I think that's what ends up happening with founders, at least on the neurological level. But we've gone back and forth about whether or not that's actually good advice.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is a pretty sizable debate in kind of the online business community in general, not just the kind of the tech startup space that we live in, but in like the more the online marketing and info marketing spaces where you'll hear people talk about, you know, whatever your passion is, you can build an audience around it and then, you know, sell stuff to that audience. And it's can be good advice, but there's also a lot of caveats to it, right? I mean, there's areas where it is actually, you know, pretty questionable advice and could very well be could be bad advice. And I think one thing that I always think of is like, does your passion have monetary value? You know, and it might directly or it might indirectly, and I'll talk a little bit about what those mean. But if your passion happens to be something that other people don't like to do, and it provides value, like being, you know, an actuary or being a CPA, like most people just don't like doing people's taxes. They don't like doing their own taxes, much less anybody else's. But if you actually really like that, there's definitely value there. Same thing with computer programming. And I couldn't believe it when I got out of college that programmers made so much, because to me, it's like I was coding on the nights and weekends. I was doing it for free and it was a hobby. It's one of the few jobs actually that people actually do as a hobby. You know, you don't hear electrical engineers designing buildings on the weekends for fun, or you don't hear CPAs doing taxes or, you know, writing, crunching numbers for fun. Most people don't do that. Whereas programmers actually do a lot of stuff for fun. So I genuinely think we are in a pretty unique and lucky place to be if that happens to be your passion, you know, building things with computer code or one of these other technical areas. And that comes back to my, you know, does your passion have monetary value directly? If you're in one of these areas, then the answer is yes.
Yeah. And how to find the people who want that activity. Because I think that applies to lots of things. Like people have all kinds of niche hobbies and interests that they're willing to pay for once, but being able to like find the community and being in touch with the community who wants the service that you want to provide is another piece of this puzzle.
That's right. And sometimes it can be finding a community, and other times it's, you know, the advice has been to build your own community. And that was kind of the second part of if perhaps your passion doesn't have direct monetary value, or it's very hard to extract that, you know, from it. Let's say that you really enjoy, you know, cooking vegan meals, or you enjoy even just thinking up, you know, inventing vegan meals, or you really like playing the guitar. These are things that can be difficult to directly monetize, right? It's like, yes, you could be in a band. Yes, you could become a chef. But if you're lifestyle, you know, constrains those things. Another path is to basically start a blog, start a podcast, you know, whatever it is, and teach people how to do these things, right? You do the meal planning, you know, you think of, you know, Happy Herbivore with Lindsay and Scott Nixon, and they have getmealplans.com. There's a paleoleap.com. I mean, there's a bunch of these services that are doing niche recipes and niche meals, and there's a good business there. So they're capitalizing on their knowledge rather than the actual output. You know, they're not like selling meals. The same thing with all the guitar teachers online. They're teaching people how to do things rather than directly monetizing. Like, you know, if you think about a developer who's working for a big company, they're directly monetizing their experience, right? They're not teaching someone else how to code, although that's lucrative as well.
Yeah, I'm even thinking about that in reflection of my own journey of, you know, beginning to do aerial yoga, really enjoying it, and thinking basically like, how can I do this more? And as a responsible grown-up, like the way to do it more is to bring it into the businesses that I'm already involved with and in, you know, into my essentially meshing it in with the work that I already do since I spend so much time doing work. I also think there's a lot of like very important therapeutic value. You know, I feel like I'm bringing more value to my clients by offering this like very unusual, but I think very helpful way of integrating physical movement and psychotherapy.
Yeah. And I think you've done a good job historically of kind of, you like to do a lot of things and it's easy to get spread too thin and pulled in too many directions. And you have learned to combine your interests or your passions, like you've said. And I think that's a good way to do it. It's going from doing to teaching, right? It's moving from that. And you're typically able to charge for teaching most things in some way, whether it's teaching online or as you're learning to do, you know, probably teaching directly live with people in a room.
So I think this advice of follow your passion, do what you love, I think that it's good advice in the sense that, you know, I've talked a lot about personal metrics over the course of the time in that we've been doing the podcast. And I think it's really important to listen to the moments of your life when you're like, oh, I love this. I'm really happy. I feel really alive and awake when I'm doing this or when I'm in this particular kind of experience. And if you know for you what really kind of gets your juices flowing and makes you feel alive, like I think it's not a bad thing to pay attention to how to spend more of your life feeling that way or more of your life doing things that you find to be rewarding and meaningful. So paying attention, really knowing what you're passionate about and what you love, I think can help prioritize your time. So you're not sort of spinning wheels or wasting time doing things that you feel mediocre about because they're available, but that you're really looking for opportunities to press into the things that are most satisfying to you. So I wouldn't like necessarily think of it as career advice as much as I would think of it as life advice. How do you practice on a daily basis being awake to your own life and to your own emotional life, your emotional responses to what's happening? And how do you maximize or optimize your life so that you have kind of, again, the most satisfaction and the most meaning?
You're talking about next level life hacks. I didn't think you liked all the life hack stuff, but this is like a higher level.
Darlin', psychologists are the original life hack.
Totally.
I don't know who you internet folk think you are, but sorry.
No, that was cool. I mean, I think, yeah, this is the point, right? This is the key. It's like, if you ignore what you really want and you ignore what you love and your passion, well, here's the thing. If you can do your passion nights and weekends, and that's cool. I have friends who do that and everything's great. I don't know if it's personality or what it is, but I know people, and it tends to be the founder types. I'm included, you're included, where it's like we find something we love and we want to just go deep and immerse ourselves in it and do it all the time. And I think about it all the time. And that can be difficult if you have this job getting in the way of the things you're really interested in. And like you're saying, we only have a certain amount of time on this earth. You can't do everything. So if you really are thinking about long-term over your life, like regret minimization framework, it's like, how can you figure out a way where you can do that all the time or at least do it more and be immersed in it? And it's one way maybe to monetize that, right? I love playing guitar. Maybe I'm going to teach people how to play guitar online. Another way could be, I love playing guitar. I also have, you know, I'm Derek Sivers, right? Who founded CD Baby. I love playing guitar and playing music. I happen to go start this company. I sell it for $22 million. Look, now I can go do whatever I want for the rest of my life. And that's an extreme example, but it is interesting to think like the seeds of a lot of founders' desire to start companies is not because they love companies, they love starting companies or love running them. It's the freedom that could bring them. And now, I mean, that's been my journey, right? We were talking the other day about how my original, you know, once I got out of college, I was like, I'm going to invest my way to financial freedom, basically to wealth. And when you're making $35,000 a year or something, that's just not going to happen. And so then the next thing was real estate. And you and I bought a bunch of houses in LA in the early 2000s. And the goal there was to get financial freedom.
You wanted to retire when you were 35. That was the
goal.
Totally.
I mean, that was a little bit of a joke. We kind of laughed, but we owned enough places that if the values hadn't crashed, like we would have kind of been set, you know? And then all the values crashed and, you know, we sold everything and luckily we made it out okay. But then it became, I mean, you and I were talking back in 2005 and it was like, huh, I have this software product that's doing a couple grand a month. Like maybe I could do a few more of these. I mean, it was literally one thing to the next. And the overarching goal was not, I want to start companies. I want to do startups. It was none of that. It was, I want this freedom and purpose in relationships as well. But like freedom was a big part of that. And so that's what it's like, two ways to look at it, right? Maybe you can monetize your passion directly, or maybe you can say, to do my passion long-term, I need to go this perhaps roundabout way of buying my own freedom.
I think either way, either sort of route that you take, if you really challenge yourself to do what you love or follow your passion, like it does create some interesting challenges and opportunities to think outside the box, to try to weave your life together in a way that's creative and, you know, forces you to kind of step off the trodden path and reevaluate or do these interesting combinations of how you bring together a way to make a living and a way to do what you love.
I think a good example of that is what you have already done with your psychology practice and your yoga practice. And you were doing those two things independently and you merged them at one point, and you're one of the few people in the country that are, or in the world for that matter, that are, you know, that are merging those two, because they are separate disciplines. And there's no, as far as I know, there's no school you can go to like learn both of these and combine them and see how it is. But you're kind of, you're pioneering by combining these two things that, you know, mind and body are so heavily related. And, you know, you talk about this in your talks, and you're able to merge these two things that you're actually quite interested in and passionate about. And that's an interesting opportunity that is outside, you know, the standard box of thinking, I'm a psychologist, so this is what I do.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm that much of a pioneer, but yeah, it's definitely, I'm sort of on the beginning of a curve of the way that people are beginning to integrate mind and body work. So all that to say, I think maybe it sounds very simple to do what you love. Like it sounds a little fluffy. So that's what makes it bad advice, because it sounds so lovely and easy. But then when you get to the nuts and bolts of like, are you actually going to make any money? Will you be able to feed yourself? Does anybody want this thing that you do? I mean, if we ground it in like a deeper way of really assessing what in life is valuable and meaningful to you, then I think it's not bad advice, but it should come with like a big warning label. Like, sounds a lot easier than it is.
Yeah. I mean, this way of living where you're really going after something you're passionate about, it requires a lot of you, right? It requires a lot of who you are. I mean, you really have to kind of be in touch with yourself, and you have to listen to what's driving you, and you have to kind of be awake. And frankly, the path that you're going to travel is going to be different than what most people around you, that your friends, that your family are doing. And you're going to perhaps seem kind of crazy to them because you just came up with an idea and you said, I'm going to go do this thing. And that's where, you know, again, referring back to that episode I had about finding your crew and finding your tribe, that's why you do need those people around you who perhaps share your passion, both for camaraderie, but for a sanity check and a level check of like, oh, people who think like I do operate this way. They do these things. And so you can kind of get an idea that this is hard, definitely harder to start a company or combine, you know, two disciplines into one practice than it is to just do the status quo. And I've always been genuinely envious of my friends, like friends from college and such, who they can go to their 9-to-5 job and they're cool at night. They weren't restless and they weren't always trying to start stuff and they weren't working nights and weekends hammering on stuff. I genuinely like, how do you do that? You know? And I was envious that they could just be that calm about things.
Yeah. I mean, passion is often depicted by like fire, you know, and it's just not that comfortable to be on fire all the time. And I mean, certainly the family that I grew up in is like, you go to work and you come home and you watch the evening news and you have dinner together and then you watch TV and then you go to bed and repeat. And that is this very like stable and predictable and in some ways comfortable life. But you and I just weren't made that way, which means that we're always a little bit angsty and a little bit charged up and, you know, like kind of living in the fire, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right. So this is, I don't know that you really have the option here. I don't know that you can choose this. I think it kind of chooses you, right? It's something in personality, but just know going into it that by following this desire or this passion, this is going to be a hard way to live and it's going to require a lot of you.
I do think that's why being a founder is hard. I mean, at that existential level, like there's so much of someone that they pour into their company or their app or whatever they're doing. It's just different than solving a problem or doing a job. It's just deeper somehow. And I think that, you know, that makes it harder. And I think why so many of us find that we're living on the edge of anxiety or edge of breakdown sometimes. And I think it's one of the reasons that this conversation about wellness and mental well-being in the founder community is so important, you know, at least from my perspective. A couple weeks ago, I interviewed Ed Finkler, who is one of the folks who is in charge of putting together open sourcing mental illness. And I wanted to mention them today because, again, I think they really get like the challenges of being a founder, being someone in technology, and living in these edge spaces where sometimes our mental well-being is a little bit at risk. And he and his community at Open Sourcing Mental Illness are really doing a lot to spread awareness and really targeting stigma within the technology world. Also, they're working a lot with technology companies to try to make companies a better place for folks who are experiencing mental health challenges. So I mentioned them because they're doing a big fundraising campaign right now. And I know a lot of you already support Zen Founder and sort of are supporting us in our endeavor to bring these kinds of topics forward in the founder community. But I also would just really want to highlight Open Sourcing Mental Illness. They're at osmihelp.org, and they're doing some really great things. So if this is something you care about and that you are thinking about, they could definitely use your support. And I think I would trust them to use those resources really well to get the word out for awareness, education, and resources for folks in the tech world who are working with challenges to mental health.
And if you're interested in hanging out with us, we're going to both be speaking at Double Your Freelancing Europe. It's Brennan Dunn's conference in Stockholm, June 16th through 19th, I think the dates are. I'm here on the website. So that's coming up in just a couple months. And, you know, Double Your Freelancing is about learning the business of freelancing from the best minds in the industry.
And I think there's some tickets left, and it's at a spa, so it's going to be really fun.
Yeah, it'll be cool. So, yeah, so hope to see you there, you know, if that kind of thing's up your alley.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.